This is Functional Medicine Update for December 2006, Volume 26, Number 12. Our topic this month is GI function. And in this edition, the subjects we will cover include differences in animal protein versus vegetable protein in an animal diet study. We will then review research on the use of statins to control cholesterol, gastropathy and issues from the use of NSAIDs, the effect of antibiotics, prebiotics, and probiotics in the treatment of GI disorders, gluten as a liver inflammatory agent, hepatic encephalopathy and GI restoration. We will explain the role of GALT and MALT in GI inflammation, and the gut-joint connection in rheumatoid arthritis. We will also ask, what is the immune privilege of the gut? Look at the gut as the seat of immunity, protein, and PYY response, and the gut as a second brain. Our interview this month is with Dr. Patrick Hanaway, a leading researcher and authority on GI function. Now, here's Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for December 2006. Can you believe that we're again at another end of a year? Wow, how the time flies by when we're having fun. We are very fortunate to have within the ranks of our functional medicine colleagues some remarkable minds, thoughtful individuals, conscious individuals who are constantly searching for truth. One of those, obviously, that stands head and shoulders above most of us is our master teacher, Dr. Sidney Baker. And after our symposium that we held in May of 2006 on biotransformation and detoxification, Dr. Baker asked a very insightful question of me related to the presentation of T. Colin Campbell from Cornell about the effect of dietary proteins on hepatic detoxification processes and aflatoxin conversion to the carcinogenic form of aflatoxin on a high animal protein diet. And his question of me was, why is it that vegetable diets did not seem to activate carcinogen in these animal studies that were exposed to aflatoxin, whereas the animal protein diets did? What was going on? I think that's a very insightful question because it raises the question as to whether it's not just protein itself, but it's something else that might come along with protein or be a part of the unique personality of animal versus vegetable protein. And I'd like to just cite a couple of interesting papers that bear on this. One is in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 131, page 1180 in 2001, that talks about the inducibility of hepatic cytochrome P450Ia enzymes by a known carcinogen when animals were fed diets that either had animal protein or vegetable protein. And they found that the vegetable protein did not activate the carcinogen, whereas the animal protein did, suggesting that the source of dietary protein may have something to do with the inducibility of the liver enzymes that go on to produce proximal to ultimate carcinogens. Similarly, another paper, again, showing a difference between soy protein isolate-fed animals and casein milk protein-fed animals with carcinogen activation. So it appears as if there's something within the constitution, structure, or function of dietary proteins that have influence on cytochrome P450 activation of carcinogens, with the animal proteins being higher activation than the vegetable proteins. This is certainly something worth further explanation because it may, in fact, help us understand the difference of cancer risk of differing types of diets, animal protein versus vegetable protein. Thank you, Dr. Baker, for getting us pointed in this direction. One of the things that we have learned in functional medicine over the years is the importance of the gastrointestinal tract in establishing a tone of overall systemic physiologic function, particularly as it relates to immune function. This issue on the December 2006 issue of Functional Medicine Update is going to focus on the gut immune function and also some collateral activities of the gut as a functional organ beyond that of its being a conduit pipe that takes things from the north to the south in this digestive process. It also has multiple other functions, and those are the things that we'll be focusing on in the course of this month's Functional Medicine Update. As you probably recognize, one of the many functions that the gut is involved with is the synthesis of cholesterol. We often think of the liver as being the principal site of cholesterol biosynthesis, which it certainly is, but the gut also plays a role in de novo cholesterol biosynthesis. And so when a person is on cholesterol-lowering medications, they're influencing not just hepatic de novo biosynthesis of cholesterol, but also having an effect on the gut function. And as you probably recognize, there is a very big move to use more and more of the statin medications to lower cholesterol. And there's this sense that statins are benign and completely safe and that we should use them aggressively to lower LDL cholesterol below 90 or even below 70, as some of the more recent suggested data. And so the questions that have been asked is, what are the impacts on immune function? What are the impacts on hepatobiliary function? What are the impacts on gastrointestinal function of making statins a part of virtually everyone's lifestyle in order to get their cholesterol LDL levels below this target of 70 milligram per deciliter? And I was very intrigued to see that in the June 5th issue of the British Medical Journal in 2006, quite an interesting controversial article was published out of investigators from Sweden entitled, "Should We Lower Cholesterol as Much as Possible?" One of the co-authors of this paper is none other than our own Mark Houston, who, as you know, is a very well-recognized leader in our functional and integrative medicine arena from Vanderbilt University School of Medicine as a clinical professor of medicine, internist, nephrologist. I think this paper is quite a dramatic story that we should be taking serious attention to. The article goes on to talk about if we were to evaluate whether higher statin doses are safe in order to get people down below the new target LDL level, we'd have to go above the equivalent of 80 milligrams of atorvastatin daily in order to get the LDL levels down. In fact, it's been suggested from looking at various clinical studies on the use of statins, the dose of statins would have to be more than 8 times higher than currently used to have the population achieve this target level of LDL. So what does that really mean in terms of potential adverse side effects? We know in the higher doses of atorvastatin that the overall mortality was not reduced because the smaller number of cardiovascular deaths in the 80 milligram atorvastatin group was offset by increased deaths from other causes, leading a benefit of fewer non-fatal cardiovascular deaths of very marginal significance. So what we're really talking about is, again, a risk-benefit trade-off. If we look at the actual number of adverse side effects that appear in these higher dose statin trials, they're much higher, says the authors, than we normally hear them about. Muscle complaints are claimed to occur in less than 1% of patients taking statins, but in a study of 22 professional athletes with familial hypercholesterolemia who were treated with various statins, 16 of the 22 discontinued the treatment because of muscle side effects. We also look at other kinds of studies looking at myopathy and rhabdomyolysis and death from renal failure. And again, it appears in a recent review of statin side effects, they found 4.2 cases of rhabdomyolysis per 100,000 patient years after atorvastatin. If true, and if the 5 cases observed in the treatment group were not due to treatment, it could mean that side effects are twice as common than have been previously acknowledged. So then we go into, obviously, some other issues which have been discussed in the literature, like mental and neurologic symptoms. We know that cholesterol is vital for the development of function of the brain and nervous system, and we start seeing on people with statins functional changes in mental and neurologic function with irritability, aggressive behavior, suicidal impulses, cognitive impairment. Then, of course, in animal trials, we see that statins have been found to be carcinogenic and alter signaling pathways for cell cycling through the farnesyl transferase reactions, and this has been suggested to then track against the increased cancer seen in these animals. Significant increase in breast cancer was seen in the cholesterol and recurrent events trial, so-called CARE trial. And so there are these questions that sit in the literature as to how safe are these products used for a long period of time and at ever higher doses to try to get down to these, quote, target low LDL levels. So the conclusion of this British Medical Journal article was that U.S. recommendations for low-density lipoprotein cholesterol concentrations could put most of the Western world adult population on statins. That might be very great for the companies that are producing the statins, but then the question is, what are the relative benefits versus risk? Doses of statins would have to be more than 8 times higher than the currently used levels if, in fact, the target low LDL was to be the measure from which people were going to be titrated to their statin dose. Increasing the dose of atorvastatin by 8 times was not found to lower total mortality. Adverse side effects in clinical trials are often underreported, and any reduction in non-fatal events may be outweighed by more numerous and more severe adverse functional side effects, say the authors. So this statin story remains controversial as it pertains to ever-increasing application of that family of drugs to try to achieve more and more aggressive lowering of LDL cholesterol. Getting back to our gastric mucosal model, let's talk a little bit about the nature of NSAID-induced enteropathy and gastropathy. As you probably recognize, about 25% of the patients on long-term non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs go on to have some form of gastropathy. In many of these, the conditions can lead to hemorrhagic problems of life-threatening consequences, and there are about 12,500 deaths that were reported annually in a 1996 study to ascribed adverse effects, fatal outcomes actually, from NSAID administration. About 106 to 110,000 hospital admissions to the emergency room from gastric bleeding from the use of NSAID. So this is not an insignificant problem. The difficulty is, how do you know early on whether a person who's taking routine NSAIDs is at risk to gastric perforation or to a serious enteropathy or gastropathy? Most people are not going to prophylactically be scoped, so you really sometimes just run the risk of the clinical trial as being the outcome as to whether a person is at risk or not. We have been involved in our research at the Functional Medicine Research Center in looking at gastric mucosal cell models for estimating relative gastrointestinal toxicity of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and in fact, recently authored a paper that was published in Prostaglandins, Leukotrienes, and Essential Fatty Acids, Volume 75, page 9, in 2006, in which we describe a method that seems to be very useful for evaluating relative toxicity to GI drugs using the AGS model, the mucosal gastric cell, mucosal cell model for screening various compounds for relative GI safety or risk. And when we do that, we find that there's a range of different GI risk factors from different non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. But even the so-called selective COX-2 inhibitor drugs that were supposedly safe to the GI tract are found by this model system to be at some risk to GI inflammatory problems. So I think there has been some relative misleading takeaway from individuals in the medical world that the selective COX-2 inhibitors are completely safe as contrasted to the traditional non-selective COX-2 inhibitors, the mixed COX-1, COX-2 inhibitor NSAIDs, that put the GI mucosa at risk. And so what we've basically found is that you need some type of a functional method for evaluating individual relative risk to NSAID-induced enteropathy, and this is where tests like the fecal calprotectin test can be very useful. And we've now used that in our research studies for the last several years and found a very close correlation between the elevation of fecal calprotectin on NSAIDs and the relative risk that that patient might have to a gastropathy. And it's very interesting to note that on a specific class of drugs, you can get a variety of different responses in different people to their NSAIDs in terms of how it affects the rising level of the reactive immune protein calprotectin that's secreted by neutrophils in the GI mucosa. So we are able to use the fecal calprotectin test as a benchmark for looking at relative risk to injury and then for the evaluation of interventions that would helpfully lower the relative risk to some kind of a serious hemorrhagic problem or a gastropathic response. As you probably recognize, when you start having gut inflammation, because the gut is the center of the immune system, as we'll learn in much more detail from our clinician of the month, you start to demonstrate localized inflammatory patterns, which then can track to altered gut mucosal integrity and can lead to upregulation of pro-inflammatory mediators, cytokines, and chemokines, and that can then ultimately deliver downstream from the gut these messengers that can enhance then liver or hepatic inflammatory response. And this seems to be more and more well recognized now that these non-specific liver injuries that relate to elevated liver enzyme profiles that don't seem to be tracked against a seropositive hep C or hep B, but yet are still present, the person is not an alcoholic, Sometimes we don't know what the etiology is of these liver profile elevations. And we go back and start looking at things like metabolic syndrome and non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or NASH is one thing that we know with liver infiltration of the hepatocytes. But another potential cause is that which comes from pro-inflammatory mediators from the gut. So we start talking about liver inflammatory conditions being precipitated by gut inflammatory conditions. So then you start looking at things like food allergies or antigenic presenting phenomena that occur to the GI mucosa. Obviously, one family that always rises up in this discussion of a problematic nature is that of gluten from wheat. So we start thinking about, well, gee whiz, if a person has a nonspecific elevation of their liver enzymes and we can't identify that this is coming from NASH or this is coming from alcohol or this is coming from a drug or this is coming as it relates to a viral infection, then could it be that this liver injury is being precipitated by an upstream antigen antibody type response at the GI mucosa and upregulation of the gut immune defense system and inflammatory mediators being produced in response. And there is a very strong body of literature that supports this contention with people who are then put on gluten-free diets, for instance, whose liver enzyme profiles go back into normal range and their gut inflammatory and liver inflammatory conditions are then going into remission. We also know that chronic gut infections, sometimes euphemistically termed dysbiosis, can also induce gut inflammatory responses, which then translate into liver-related problems. We also recognize that in older age individuals where you often get this condition called hepatic encephalopathy with psychosis developing, that this can be precipitated by this gut inflammation-liver connection to brain through the glia, the microglia. And remember, the microglia is the brain's immune system. And so there can be an upregulation and an alteration of immune function in the brain with altered neurotransmitters and increased inflammatory agents, activation of glial nitric oxide output and all these things, peroxynitrite being formed. And now we have a whole different brain milieu in terms of its functional molecules. So long-term use of antibiotics can induce changes in gut flora. Gut flora can then induce changes in gut immune function. Gut immune function can change the liver can change the brain, and voila, now we have a round-robin connection between gastroenterology and neurology. There's a very nice paper that actually describes all of this web-like connection, which sounds very reminiscent, doesn't it, to a functional medicine argument, that appeared in the journal Medical Hypothesis in 2005, volume 64, page 64, entitled Effective Antibiotics, Prebiotics, and Probiotics in the Treatment of Hepatic Encephalopathy. And as you probably recognize, hepatic encephalopathy has traditionally been treated by putting a person on a substance that will create hyperosmolar diarrhea, like the disaccharide lactulose, which is non-absorbable generally, and that diarrhea then alters gut flora, and it also washes out toxins from bacterial cell wall debris and lowers the load of inflammatory materials, which then lowers the effect on the liver and then ultimately lowers the middle molecular weight nitrogenous molecule load on the brain and can help a person come out of this hallucinations that are associated with hepatic encephalopathy. Obviously, the real name for that should be gastrointestinal hepatic encephalopathy because it's the gut connected to the liver, connected to the brain. So can prebiotics and probiotics also be useful for managing this kind of a condition? And there is a wide body of literature that's described in this review article that suggests that not just lactulose itself as a substance to produce hyperosmolar diarrhea, but also prebiotics and probiotics work together to help in proper normalization of GI immune defense, lowering inflammation, lowering liver activation, therefore improving the microglial function, the brain's immune system, and reducing the symptoms of hepatic encephalopathy. We often think of hepatic encephalopathy as only being associated with ammonia-producing organisms, and we kind of characterize it often as a condition of hyperammonemia. But actually, if you look at the literature, you'll find that the symptoms of hepatic encephalopathy, the hallucinations, are not tracked closely against blood ammonia levels at all, but rather tracked against other nitrogenous putative precursor molecules to neurotransmitters, which are immune active substances that are produced in the gut and or liver and are associated with these gut inflammatory conditions. So encouraging then the detoxification of the gut, re-inoculation with friendly bacteria, using pre- and probiotics appear to be part of a favorable clinical protocol. Then we talk about gut restoration, giving nutrients that are helpful for restoring proper gut immune defense, like L-glutamine, which we know is a useful amino acid for improving gut mucosal integrity. It's a gut fuel in some respects, and it helps also to activate in situ glutathione stores for proper redox balance and gut mucosal recovery of immune defense. So a lot of different parts of this story, but certainly lowering the load, getting rid of food antigens or allergens, improving prebiotic and probiotic re-inoculation of the gut, and then gut restoration of mucosal integrity with nutrients like L-glutamine all seem to be part of this program that connects the gut to the liver. So if we see these elevated liver enzyme profiles, I think we should take a broader net to look at the implications other than that of just serology for hepatitis-producing organisms. That also leads then to the question of systemic inflammatory conditions and how they might be connected to localized gut immune activation and enhanced immune activities of the gastrointestinal-associated lymphoid tissue, or what has been abbreviated as GALT or GALT. And as you know, there is ever-increasing interest in this whole spectrum of autoimmune disorders that may have some connection in certain individuals to alteration in their gut immune defense. This connection that appeared maybe very strange 10 years ago is now starting to gain much more credibility between the activity and function of the MALT, the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue, and the GALT, the gastrointestinal-associated lymphoid tissue, and systemic inflammatory responses. So are there any animal models that take a look at this connection? And the answer is, yeah, there is certainly an ever-increasing number of well-respected animal models where this connection can be studied under controlled conditions. In fact, there's a very nice review that appeared just recently in the Arthritis Research Journal that's entitled The Genetics of Rheumatoid Arthritis and the Need for Animal Models to Find and Understand the Underlying Genes. And in this particular paper, they do talk about new animal models that are being used for evaluating the potential of rheumatoid arthritis and the etiology of rheumatoid arthritis from an animal model and how that connects to certain immune-related genetic characteristics, and then what environmental modifiers can modify the genetic expression of these characteristics to give rise to an immunological inflammatory condition that later tracks as arthritis. So if we think of rheumatoid arthritis, obviously, as an autoimmune disease, and we get some sense that there could be cross-reactivity between epitopes that appear in the environment and ultimate translation that as superantigens into cross-reaction with host tissue, then we start asking what environmental factors might be those cross-reacting epitopes. One family of organisms that have been described are those organisms that have urinary tract infection correlations like Proteus organisms. And there is an interesting paper that just appeared in Clinical and Developmental Immunology, Volume 13, page 48, in 2006, that looks at the relationship between rheumatoid arthritis and the linkage with Proteus mirabilis infection of the urogenital tract. They propose that a subclinical Proteus urinary tract infection could be a main triggering factor related to this molecular mimicry and cross-reactivity between bacterial and RA-targeted tissue antigens that both perpetuate the disease through the production of cytopathic autoantibodies. And so, again, we start saying, well, this is a complex world in which we live, in which there are literally thousands of microorganisms that have their own molecular personalities. On their surface sit all sorts of different potentially haptenic or antigenic components, which may then react with receptor sites on host immune tissue in genetically unique individuals to activate those cells into a heightened sense of inflammatory expression. The urinary tract may seem like a long way away from the joints, but we're all connected together through our immune system. So in this particular paper, they talk about this may explain why vegetarian diets, diets that are higher in water and juices that are acidic and contain certain phytochemicals like cranberry juice have been useful in certain studies with patients not only with urinary tract infections but who have conjoint arthritis. And they find that as their diets change and their urinary tract infections improve, that their joint pain improves too, because there is this connection through the immune system between the reaction of receptor sites to antigens, these cross-reactive materials, this mimicry, so to speak, between a bacterial antigen and a self-antigen. So I think that we're starting to learn a lot more about these interrelationships in this complex world, which then is individualized to the patient's own immune system. We can't just form rules that cut across all individuals, and we can't say there's only one cause of an autoimmune disease. We're looking at modifying factors. And then, of course, that relates to this gut-joint connection in arthritis and foods. Is there any demonstrable connection between the foods in our diet and their personality, their chemical personalities, that relates to their immunological activity and cross-reactivity with antibodies that are associated with rheumatoid arthritis? Well, that's a question that's been discussed for, several decades at least that I've been in the field, and I'm sure well before that. But as we get better immunological assessment tools, the association becomes more and more well recognized. And I'm now quoting from a very recent paper that appeared in the journal Gut, which describes this very well, this connection that couples together the cross-reactivity to food antibodies and ultimately joint inflammatory conditions. And this appeared in the volume 55 of the journal Gut, page 1240 in 2006. This is a very interesting paper. It's actually, the title is The Gut-Joint Axis, Cross-Reactive Food Antibodies and Rheumatoid Arthritis. This was a study that was aimed for patients with rheumatoid arthritis who have differing severity of their condition that seems to track against different dietary persuasions or different foods that they might eat. So they wanted to investigate a putative immunological link between gut immunity, rheumatoid arthritis, food antibodies, and general quality of the diet in these individuals who have this food exacerbation. So they looked at IgG, IgM, and IgA antibodies to dietary antigens to measure the potential for food allergy in these individuals in serum and jejunal perfusates from 14 rheumatoid arthritis patients and 20 healthy subjects. And the antigens that they found were higher prevalent, originated from cow's milk, alpha-lactobumin, beta-lactoglobulin, and casein, the three most reactive proteins in cow's milk, cereals containing obviously gluten, ovalbumin, which is hen's egg, codfish, and pork meat were the antigens that were evaluated. In intestinal fluid of many rheumatoid arthritis patients, all three immunoglobulin classes showed increased food-specific activities. Except for IgM activity against beta-lactoglobulin, all other IgM activities were significantly increased irrespective of the total IgM level. So you have to look at the individual class of IgM. The rheumatoid-associated serum IgM antibody responses were relatively much less pronounced. And compared with IgM, the intestinal IgA activities were less consistently raised with no significant increase against gliadin and casein. Considerable cross-reactivity of IgM and IgA antibodies was documented by looking at lactulose mannitol and other intestinal absorption tests. Although intestinal IgG activity to food was quite low, it was nevertheless significantly increased against many antigens in the rheumatoid arthritis patients. Three of the five rheumatoid arthritis patients treated with sulfasalazine for 16 weeks had initially raised levels of intestinal food antibodies, indicating increased intestinal permeability, and these became normalized after treatment. So they conclude, after looking at this fairly, small number of patients in the trial, 14 RA patients against the 20 healthy subjects, that the production of cross-reactive antibodies is strikingly increased in the gut of many rheumatoid arthritis patients. And I think that's probably the most significant contribution to the study, was looking at intestinal perfusates and examining what the localized production of antibodies through the activation of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue was as a consequence of exposure to their complex diet. Their food-related problems reflect an adverse additive effect on multiple modest hypersensitivity reactions, and these may then promote more severe autoimmune reactions in the joints. So they come to the conclusion that this gut-joint axis is not just theoretic, that it actually does exist, and it's a clinically demonstrable factor that on food elimination or improved gut immune function, normalizing gut immune function, that it translates to lower systemic and joint-related inflammatory conditions. So I think that this is very, very important because often I hear people say, gee whiz, what happens in the gut wouldn't translate to the joints. They're controlled and isolated and compartmentalized by barriers of defense and whole different physiological control systems. So that's an extrapolation of unreasonableness. However, both systemic and intestinal humoral immunity is found to be aberrant in rheumatoid arthritis patients with a particularly striking elevation of cross-reactive food antibodies in the proximal gut secretions. We now learn from this more recent paper that IgM reactivity against food items was increased in the serum as well as in the intestinal profusate, suggesting systemic as well as localized effects, and that these incremental increases in intestinal antibodies provide striking results suggesting a connection between mucosal immune activation and the pathogenesis of rheumatoid arthritis, at least we can say in some patients. And again, I want to emphasize that I think, like all diseases, rheumatoid arthritis is a heterogeneous condition with many different contributing variables. So we can't say one rule covers all patients, but certainly it's a characteristic that's worth looking at. And that's the diet connection to antibody exacerbation of these autoantibodies. Food, therefore, may have an additive effect on other risk factors or contributing factors to the etiology of immune imbalance that's associated with rheumatoid arthritis. So the gut immune defense functions, the environmental allergens and toxins, stress factors, these are all contributors to imbalanced immune function that we associate with these arthritis-like conditions. Now, what I've really been talking about in this discussion is a presaging of what our clinician researcher of the month, Dr. Hanaway, will be saying much more eloquently, and that is, what is the immune privilege of the gut and the establishment and maintenance of proper immune response upon exposure to dietary antigens and commensal flora, which can be either friend or foe? We know that the intestines represent a new site for immune privilege. In fact, as early as 1948, Peter Medawar, who, as you know, was an early transplantation immunologist, coined the term immune privilege to refer really to the experimental observation that allogenic solid tissue grafts survive for prolonged or indefinite periods of time in specialized sites of the body. This relates to immune allostasis, or control of immune function. The pregnant uterus, ovary, testes, hair follicles, and regions of the eye and brain are among those anatomical sites traditionally classified as immune privileged. So this immune privilege was largely due to passive mechanisms and immunological ignorance. In other words, antigenic material transplanted into the immune privileged site, hidden from the systemic immune system, secondary, obviously, to barriers like vascular barriers and the absence of lymph drainage. However, if you expose these tissues by opening portals of entry to them to antigenic insults, now they can lose their immune privilege and become no longer naive, but be activated. It was later shown that traditional immune privileged sites are privy to lymphatic drainage, and more significantly, by the 1970s, it had been demonstrated that antigen placement in the anterior chamber of the eye, a traditional immune privileged site, did in fact generate a systemic immune response, even if the response did not lead to graft rejection. As a result, immune privilege was recognized to result from active rather than passive immunoregulatory processes, and so it's how you control this Th1, Th2, type of response and maintain balance. So when we look at the gut immune privilege, it's really buttressed and affected by many factors. On one side, you might think of it as food, which is containing many foreign molecules. And in fact, unless you're a cannibal, you're probably not eating molecules from which you're made. So the diet contains foreign molecules that have to be digested and translated into neutral molecules relative to the information that they provide to the body, at least not seen as hostile molecules. On the other side, we've got this 2.5 to 3 pounds of organisms sitting in our gastrointestinal tract that represent immunologically potentially active organisms. They could be trophic and have positive impact upon immune function. They could be, as you know, parasitic, and they could release caustic chemicals that activate the immune system and then cause immunological imbalance and inflammation. So our immune privilege of the gut is really maintained by this dynamic tension and balance between intestinal epithelial barriers, phagocytic innate immune cells, tolerogenic antigen-presenting cells, regulatory adaptive immune cells that gives rise then to tolerance to this environment that is within our gastrointestinal system. imbalances of this or alteration in the regulation leads to dysfunction, and that can be related then to mucosal breakdown and ultimately then to what we call increased permeability or leaky gut. So I think that then exposes the gastrointestinal associated lymphoid tissue or GALT to immunologically activating substances, imbalancing the teeter-totter of immune defense between the thymus-dependent 1 and the thymus-dependent 2 lymphocytes, and now what we end up getting are altered chemical communicators, cytokines and chemokines that relate either to things like food allergy or inflammatory bowel disease and activated immune system function. So this concept, which is emerging to look at the gut as a seat of immunity, is a very, very important concept in functional medicine and complex chronic disease, because the conditions that result from this are more than just gastrointestinal in name. It's not just the purview of the gastroenterologist alone. We then further amplify or complicate that by the recognition that the gut is also a very active site for the secretion of many neuroactive substances. It's the site where the majority of serotonin is secreted in the body. In fact, I think nearly two-thirds of whole organism serotonin comes from secretion from the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. We also recognize that various brain neurotransmitters, not just cholecystokinin, but also PYY, are altered by gut immune defense and the contents of the diet. In fact, recently it's been found that the gut hormone PYY is released when a person eats a higher protein-containing food that then sends to the brain signals that indicate fullness, as contrasted to empty calorie foods that are devoid of protein, where you get lowered PYY release and lowered satiety message that's triggered to the brain. So this might explain why eating protein in adequate levels with a diet then has a positive effect on controlling appetite and the feeling of fullness. This is recent work actually that's been done by Rachel Batterham and her colleagues that have been looking at the University College of London, trying to understand diet and its relationship to appetite and obesity. So I think we can think of the gut as the second brain. As Dr. Michael Gershon pointed out, we can think of the gut as a site for the immune system function. We can think of the gut as having a very important digestive function in terms of breaking big to small for absorption. And we can think then of the gut as controlling water content, fluid balance, electrolyte balance. It's much more of a functional organ than just a conduit, a pipe that connects the mouth to the anus. And I think that that's the theme that's emerging. And then it's more fully understood if we can start thinking as a bioreactor, that there are these gut microflora that convert primary substances and foods into secondary metabolites. For instance, things like the soy isoflavones get converted by certain enteric bacteria into secondary metabolites like Equal, that has a different effect on physiology once absorbed than does the lignin or the isoflavone themselves. We know, for instance, in work that we've been doing in our functional medicine research center around Humulus lupulus, which is hops, if you look at some of the factors in hops that are the so-called hydrophilic components of the water-soluble components, that they get converted, like isoxanthohumol, into xanthohumol by demethylating bacteria that appear in the gut through fermentation. So there are certain types of enteric bacteria that would create different types of secondary metabolites that modify physiological function. And this story goes on and on in terms of many other examples where fermentation produces secondary compounds that have differing effects on physiology. And this is dependent upon the specific families of enteric organisms to do this. An alteration of those organisms by antibiotics or stress or altered diet or high salt or sweet diets that flatten the villi can all influence the secondary effects of these bioreactors on producing these physiologically active materials. So you can notice that we're much more complicated in our understanding of functional gastroenterology than we previously have taken into account. And it's that that leads us really into this month's discussion with our Clinician Researcher of the Month, Dr. Patrick Hanaway, who is really an expert in this whole area of looking at how gut immune defense, flora, and mucosal integrity interrelate to a whole series of functional chronic health-related problems. So with that in mind, let's move to our Clinician of the Month. Well, once again, we're at that place in functional medicine update that, as I've reviewed now over the last 25-plus years, is for me the time that I look forward to with the greatest anticipation, because I've learned so much from the various clinicians and researchers that I've had the privilege of interviewing. And that certainly holds true for this month as well, as I have a chance to speak with both a colleague that I've admired and respected professionally and also a great personal friend, Dr. Patrick Hanaway, who is, I'm sure many of you know, a very important figure in our field of integrative medicine, a person who is a board-certified family physician, got his medical doctorate degree from Washington University and residence training in the University of New Mexico, very skilled both in what we would consider the analytic reductionistic form of medicine and also having studied traditional Chinese medicine and integrative medicine, and is a true integrator in every sense of the word, but does so in a way that really, I think, exercises the best of balance of both hemispheres of the brain. So it's a great privilege to have Dr. Hanaway as our clinician researcher of the month. And Patrick, how did you go about making this kind of interesting transition in your career from being a family doctor to now being a leader in the field of integrative functional medicine?
Well, thank you for that introduction, Jeff. The path was really the extension of the path that I had when I was in college and went to medical school. I was of the belief that I was going to learn about health and healing. I had majored in both history and molecular biology, and when I learned about biochemistry, I thought I was going to learn about nutrition. I thought I was going to learn about what things people put in their mouths and how that works. I didn't learn that. I read a book by you, actually, in 1980 that helped me to believe that it's possible. There's some people thinking about that. And as I went through my training and became a family doctor, I continued to be interested in, you know, how do I apply principles of good medicine, of connecting back to nature and eating right food and having vitamins and nutrients that are going to help to maintain optimal wellness, because that's what I was interested in. And I've had this great opportunity to learn these tools along the way.
Well, I know you've made a very interesting transition professionally. You and your wife have been in practice together. She's a physician as well, and you've had your home for a whole family health care in Asheville, North Carolina. And then within the last decade, you made a pretty remarkable career change to become chief medical officer at Genova Diagnostics and really become, a very well-respected leader in the area of functional gastroenterology. So this clearly is a lifelong learning program. It seems like an interesting evolution of your professional career.
Well, it is, and as you know, there's always a personal story behind it as well. And so part of my growing into learning about functional GI illness stemmed from 3 months of work in Nepal and India back when I was in my medical training. Getting very sick with amoebic dysentery certainly helped to stimulate my interest in the GI tract. And learning how to come back into balance, learned about Great Smoky's Diagnostic Lab at that time in the early 90s, and it helped me tremendously to come back into balance. And so in my clinical practice, I needed to understand how to use tools. As I hung out my shingle, I needed to understand what are the tools that I can use to help bring people back into balance, and how can I understand how they're biochemically unique from each other so that I can really be able to optimize my healing potential with that person. So that's what I did, and it occurred that I was fortunate that I was practicing with my wife in Asheville, and the laboratory that you speak of, now known as Genova Diagnostics, was in town, and I said, you know, hey, I'd like to do some clinical research, and began to do that and began to see that the opportunity to share these approaches and these tools and this understanding with more of my colleagues was really a way that I could best use my skills to help advance medicine and healing.
Well, that's a wonderful opportunity to segue into what I think is one of the most useful articles that I've seen written in this field of functional gastroenterology, which just happens to be authored by you. It appeared in the September-October 2006 issue of Alternative Therapies under the title Balance of Flora Galt, that's the gastrointestinal-associated lymphoid tissue, and mucosal integrity. And I think this way that you laid this article out is in part a manifesto for a change in thinking about integrated physiology or functional physiology. And I'd like to, for the sake of the listeners, kind of walk through some of this article and also some of the citations that you've provided that give support to these concepts, because I don't believe these concepts are necessarily held in every quarter of gastroenterology. So it's very interesting to see how these thoughts have evolved through your lens and also through the field of clinical and basic science research. So with that as kind of a context, maybe you can tell us a little bit in summary about, for those maybe who are less familiar about the gastrointestinal associated lymphoid tissue, about the gut flora and interrelationship with the gut immune system.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And it's interesting that while these things are not commonly remembered and understood, much of it is a recapitulation of work that Eli Metchnikoff did at the turn of the last century, for which he won, you know, Nobel Prize in Medicine. And these are old concepts that we're re-remembering. And the big issue is that in our immune system, the way in which we relate and interface with the world, the way in which we determine self from non-self, 70% of that immune system is present in our gut, in our gastrointestinal tract. And that the way in which it grows to be able to educate itself, the way in which it learns, is actually through interrelationship with the environment, interrelationship with the food that we eat, and also with the old friends that we come in contact with, the normal commensal bacterial flora, even parasites, worms, viruses, all these things. That's what educates our immune system to be able to say, are you a friend or are you a foe? Am I going to mount an inflammatory reaction to you, or am I going to say, everything here is okay, and I'm going to be tolerant of these particular foods or these particular antigens that are presenting themselves. You know, that entire process is one, that unfolding of being able to set the stage. And the most fascinating part in this to me is that the way in which you set the stage in the first 2 years of life has ramifications for what your gut flora will be and what your set point is for the remainder of your life.
Well, I think that's a really important concept, because it again gets back to this, to go back to one of your historic experiences when you were in Nepal. Obviously, you had an environmental exposure that created a change in your enteric flora, which caused a change or was interrelated with a change of your gut immune defenses. And undoubtedly, you went back to where your whole system was as an early infant and some of the things that you might have been exposed to and how that developed the ability to respond to that stress. Because inevitably, maybe we don't all go to Nepal, but I guess we all exposed to these stressors that then call forth these reserves.
Well, we do. And Michael Gershon has talked so much about the second brain and this concept and the interrelationship between the gut and the brain. There are more neurotransmitters in the gut than there are in the brain. So the stresses that we have in our life as well have a tremendous impact. It's not just the physical biological influences, but also the psychological stressors that can also have an effect on how our gut functions.
Well, I know that in your article you talk a lot about this concept of tolerance versus intolerance as it pertains to this interface between our enteric immune system and our enteric bacteria. So could you tell us a little bit about how do we gain tolerance, and then why has intolerance become evident in other people?
The immunologic crosstalk that is a part of the ongoing education of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue of the immune system is a process where the body is constantly sampling. It's using lymphocytes that are lining the intestinal wall. So the intestinal wall spread out is as big as a doubles tennis court. And in it, you're putting in antigens, 30 to 50 tons of food over a lifetime. And there are bacterial flora that outnumber us 10 to 1. There are 100 trillion bacteria in our gut and 10 trillion cells in our body. And so the body is constantly sampling with its immune system to say, who's out there? And it samples based upon different kinds of receptors, so-called toll-like receptors, that are receptors that are set. They're pre-programmed to be able to understand what the appropriate relationship is supposed to be with our environment. And in the stimulation of that, they either get turned on or they get turned off. And that all happens through the inflammatory process and the cycling that you've talked about, through, you know, nuclear factor kappa B and the stimulation of the cytokine system. And it either stimulates a stimulatory cytokine in the presence of pathogens like Clostridia difficile or Entamoeba histolytica or E. coli 0157. So it stimulates like interleukin 12, or it says, hey, this is lactobacillus and bifidobacter, and they're friends that I want to have around. And it stimulates a counter-regulatory, a non-inflammatory cytokine, interleukin 10, to slow things down. Now, there are many other cytokines in that cascade, but that's how the body creates the set point. The fascinating thing is that we do see that there are some people who are more predisposed because they have alterations either in their toll-like receptors or in their inflammatory cascade, where they will mount an inflammatory response in the presence of normal organisms. There's a whole subset of Crohn's disease that's associated with the NOD2 or toll-like receptor gene that are associated with that form of developing inflammatory bowel disease.
I know that an article that just recently appeared from an author that you're very familiar with, because I think you've had personal contact with him, is a very prominent gastroenterologist, University of North Carolina School of Medicine, Balfour Sartor, who talks about the mechanism of disease, colitis, IBD, and so forth, in Nature Gastroenterology in 2006. He's proposed kind of a model that seems like it has general applicability to many of these disorders of immune dysfunction that cut across different diagnostic criteria. Could you kind of summarize what he was speaking to in this article?
I'm kind of smiling because the first time I heard him talk, I actually thought I was at a Jeff Bland functional medicine meeting, because he said the reactivation of disease occurs when environmental factors trigger changes, trigger a break in the mucosal barrier, so-called leaky gut, and they stimulate immune responses and alter the balance between beneficial and pathogenic bacteria in the gut. Now, I've just read a statement from the summary of his review in Nature Clinical Practice Gastroenterology from 2 months ago, and that's something that we've been talking about in the functional medicine arena for more than 15 years. So it's fascinating to me to see that the cutting-edge researchers, and he is an immunologist and a GI doc who is speaking to thousands and tens of thousands of people, are converging at the same idea of where balance and imbalance arises from.
I remember a number of years ago we had the fortune of having Dr. Michael Gershon at the Institute for Functional Medicine annual symposium talk on his second brain concept and the gut-brain connection. And one of the things he was talking about, obviously, was irritable bowel syndrome, which he spent quite a bit of time researching. And out of that seemed to come a connection of functional gastroenterological diseases before you get to this acute pathology that we often think of in gastroenterology. They're always dealing with more the acute illnesses of the GI tract, but these functional illnesses that have more subtle symptom profiles and may be connected to alterations in the hypothalamic pituitary gut axis. And in fact, there's, I think, a more recent paper that I just saw in the American Journal of Gastroenterology a year ago talking about the HPA connection to the gut immune defense and cytokines. So for the sake of our listeners, could you differentiate kind of a functional gastroenterological collection of disorders from that of a pathologic? What types of things are we actually looking at clinically?
Well, I would first state that it's my emerging view that these really constitute a continuum, and that there's not a set of functional disorders and a set of pathophysiologic disorders that are going on. So when we see something that's called like a functional bowel disorder, like inflammatory bowel disease, or the new term for kids is recurrent abdominal pain, RAP, which are these garbage cans of symptoms that we don't know what's really going on, and so we call it a functional disorder. What we see is there's actually probably something on the order of 1 in 10 people who have IBS who go on to develop inflammatory bowel disease, that it may be a precursor in some situations because it's a further extension of that imbalance between the environment and the individual, that gene-environment interaction that's going on. So the functional disorders that Dr. Gershon, Michael Gershon, talks about are focusing on how do we understand this symptom complex of irritable bowel syndrome that now is present in about 15% of all Americans. You know, it's extremely common, and we know intuitively that this has to do with the kinds of foods that we're putting into our diet. And my own belief, more and more from a clinical perspective, is that the alterations in gut flora are so extensive that our immune system is not working properly, the gut flora are not doing their normal transformation, detoxification, and metabolic activity to help us to stay in balance with our environment. And in more extreme cases, that will then manifest itself as ongoing ear inflammation that we see in Crohn's and colitis. Just a side note there, the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation has been working with Kaiser Permanente, and they're going to be publishing in the next year data that shows that the rates of Crohn's and colitis have doubled in the United States from 900,000 to 1.75 million over the past 9 years.
Wow.
Amazing information.
Wow. So this continuum that you're describing sounds like the trajectory that people might travel through is through less severe conditions of dysfunctional gut immune system, ultimately moving into more pathologic states, which then means they could pass through things like what we generally call IBS-like symptoms. And I was very intrigued to see in gastroenterology in February of this year an article talking about plasma cytokines as a potential biomarker for IBS, again showing a unified concept of inflammation even at the early stages of IBS. Has that been your experience when you've looked at some of these patients with less severe GI dysfunctions?
Exactly, and we also see that there's a subset of those who have post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome. Those are people who have mucosal markers like fecal calprotectin also being elevated, showing that there is an inflammatory process that goes on that then moves in from the mucosal lining into the submucosa and into the smooth muscle where it interrelates. There's further work out of Canada showing that where the nerve cells come in is right next to where the mast cells and enterochromaffin cells are releasing histamines and serotonin. So that gives us an understanding of why, when there's an inflammatory process, a low-grade inflammation that's going on, that there's stimulation of changes in gut motility, bloating, a sense of pain, a sense of fullness that's associated with IBS. So you can see how that inflammatory process at a low grade is really generating much of the symptomatology that's going on. And in addition to that, when we have that process of low-grade inflammation, this breakdown in mucosal barrier integrity, what the GI docs will call intestinal permeability and what the naturopaths will call leaky gut, describing the same phenomena, then creates the opportunity for other autoimmune phenomena to occur.
So that obviously leads us into a clinical question, which is, how does a clinician then assess the need of the patient for intervention? Are there specific tests, or do we go off clinical presentation as the principal, or is it a combination of functional tests with clinical presentation?
Well, it's always a combination of the two, because we see that in order to understand the biochemical individuality of a person who's coming in, so that we can use the tools of functional medicine to be able to help bring them back into balance, we can use both our tools of understanding the history, listening to the story, seeing how the pieces fit together, using our physical exam to see what imbalances may be going on, using laboratory testing to give us a further sense of where are we going to get the best opportunity. Forgot to mention that the family history as well, of where do they have a genetic predisposition of having imbalance, and using all those tools together to be able to drive and apply the right therapeutic modality, the thing that's going to get the biggest bang for the buck.
Are the tests that are used for measuring gut mucosal integrity of value in this assessment to know how to both track the patient and what treatment regime to use?
Certainly. I know you've spoken of Ingvar Bjarnsson before, who's done more recent research not only on NSAIDs and their role in relationship in increasing gut permeability and causing problems with inflammation there, but previous work that he did helping to develop tests like the double sugar test, looking at intestinal permeability. Those are useful tools to see, is there a breakdown in the gut mucosal integrity that's occurring? Is there inflammation that's going on, using tools like calprotectin to be able to tell that? Are there changes in the gut flora? I'm excited about work that's being done around the world right now, being able to begin to really describe the microbiome of the gut, understanding what are the 400-plus species that are there and how do we help bring people back into balance. But in 2006, we're relying on stool culture to give us an idea of, are the right amount of beneficial bacteria present and the right balance? And are there other bacteria that are not pathogenic in and of themselves, but in combination, when there's an alteration of the gut flora, they cause a dysbiosis that leads to further inflammation?
I'm so excited to hear you talk about that, because I recall, this is one of those Back to the Future reflections of a series of lectures that were given back in the 1970s when I was first starting in this field, middle 1970s, by a gastroenterologist from, I think he was in Santa Barbara, Ventura, California, who spoke about stool cultures as a way of assessing functional GI disorders. And obviously back in the mid-70s, that was pretty strange for gastroenterologists to hear. It seems a little less strange now in 2006, 2007 than it did then, but that was pretty advanced, talking about culturing the stool to see if you could pick up imbalanced organisms.
Like, go back to Metchnikoff and the work with probiotics, the work with commensal flora and yogurts, you know, natural fermented products. They are, in my belief and my practice, critical tools for helping to bring balance back to a system that fundamentally becomes imbalanced in most young children during the first 2 years of life through the use of both vaccines, antiseptic birth conditions, significant amounts of antibiotics, and even the antimicrobial herbs that cause alterations, the lack of breastfeeding in our culture, and the introduction of solid foods in a far more rapid phase than our gut evolutionarily was meant to be exposed to.
So I'd like to just go back, if I could, for a minute to the assessment phase, because for some people who may be new to this field, they don't understand the double sugar test that you described, the lactulose mannitol challenge test, nor do they probably understand the fecal calprotectin test and how those give different bits of information in clinical management. Could you just kind of give us a summary of both those tests?
Sure. The test for intestinal permeability, developed back in 1985, by Dr. Bjarnason and his colleagues, is pretty simple in nature. We give someone two sugars. We give them lactulose and we give them mannitol. Many of the MDs may remember lactulose as a treatment that causes an osmotic diarrhea. I'll give small amounts of that. Lactulose is a relatively large molecule and wouldn't normally go through the gut wall. Mannitol is a smaller molecule and would commonly go through the gut wall. We can measure in someone's urine how much lactulose and mannitol are there at time zero, and then 6 hours after we give the drink, how much lactulose and mannitol are there, and that tells us how much was absorbed through the gut. We see conditions when there's a breakdown of the gut of the paracellular junctions. Zonulin and other measures are broken down, are not working properly, and the gates open up. These large lactulose molecules are able to move through, and we can find them in the urine. Conversely, some people will not only have problems with the lactulose coming through in high amounts, but they'll also have inflammation which causes a breakdown of the villi, the finger-like projections that come out from the lining of the intestine that are part of the absorption process. And when those are broken down, it can't absorb the mannitol properly. And so we can get an indication not only of intestinal permeability, but also of malabsorption that goes on from this very simple test.
And how does that connect to or give different information from the fecal calprotectin test that you alluded to earlier?
Calprotectin is something I've been working with the GI community, got FDA approval on that just earlier this year, and I've been working with GI docs around the world doing research on that marker. That's a marker from the white blood cell, the neutrophil. 60% of the protein in a normal white blood cell is going to have this zinc binding protein called calprotectin. And it's released by the white blood cell as a defense mechanism to help bind zinc so bacterial enzymes are not able to work. So it acts as a bacteriostatic measure within the cell. We are also able to use it as a quantitative marker of inflammation. And so we can find out how much inflammation is going on, determine if irritable bowel syndrome has an inflammatory component in it, use it to be able to determine which children especially might have not a functional bowel problem but an inflammatory bowel disease going on and who should be scoped, and further studies now looking at it as a monitoring tool to follow patients with inflammatory bowel disease. So it gives us an insight. And then there's one other new finding on that that's really fascinating, which takes us out of the realm of the gut but into the overall inflammatory processes, its role in relationship with disease that you've talked about, including at the Fire Within in Vancouver several years ago, that calprotectin can be used as an indicator of who's at risk for developing a myocardial infarction when measured in the plasma, more sensitive than hsCRP. Data from Circulation in August of this year from Dr. Dan Simon at Harvard.
Well, this is, again, I guess, showing unified mechanisms, isn't it, that you don't just have action in a local area. You may have think locally, act globally type of phenomena going on here. You talked earlier also very nicely in your review paper about the use of probiotics, which I think for most people in our field, they have some familiarity with. But I was very intrigued when I read this gastroenterology article in February 2006 talking about plasma cytokines as biomarkers for IBS. And in that paper, they talked about the use of probiotics at the dose of 3.6 trillion organisms a day, which by most people's assessment would be a pretty massive dose of probiotics. Do you have any thoughts about very high dose probiotics? And if so, what you're really doing? Because it sounds like it may be beyond just re-inoculation. You may be actually adding tropic factors or some bioactive components at that level.
Clearly, I think that we've learned that we've been acting, at least within the probiotic strains that are available commercially over the past 20 years, dealing with more homeopathic dosing patterns, and that in order to really be able to get into true therapeutic ranges with probiotics, we need to go to larger doses. So now commonly we see people using 50 to 100 billion colony-forming units with patients with IBS. Data with VSL3 out of Italy is now looking at 450 billion colony-forming units, and they're doing research, as you said, much, much higher at 2.7 and 3.6 trillion colony-forming units as ways of being able to really act as anti-inflammatory measures. When we recognize that the gut has 100 trillion bacteria present in it, using a dose of 2 or 3 trillion is not unreasonable, and I think that the higher doses of probiotics I've found to be very effective, and there's still a large margin of safety using probiotics in this way. There's one thing I want to also acknowledge in this arena of looking at probiotics and imbalances in our gut, and it has to do with celiac disease. We've seen in the course of my career from the time I was in med school, where celiac disease was first said to be 1 in 3,000 and then 1 in 1,250, and now the last data says, oh, 1 in 133 people have it, and probably 1 in every 50 people who have IBS have celiac disease, with true changes going on in their tissue transglutaminases. But data out of Italy also shows us that when people have the right amount of commensal flora, all of the enzymes necessary to break down gliadin and gluten are present. And so maybe it's not just a genetic factor that's going on that we're uncovering, but maybe it's that there are such changes in our gut flora that we don't have the capacity to break down wheat like we did before. And those people with the genetic predispositions of DQ2 and DQ8 are those who are at highest risk for not being able to effectively break down wheat in their diet.
That's a really important point. I'm really glad you brought that up. This whole HLA genotype and its connection to these preformed diseases of allergy tends to, I think, reduce some of the other modifying factors like you've just described that could influence the expression of that genotype as a phenotype. So I think that is a very, very useful observation and helps us to understand the increase in prevalence of some of these conditions. It's not just sand pile genotypes that we're talking about. It's environmental factors that have modified the expression. So that then leads to a similar clinical question, which I often hear, and I know you do as well, and that is, do some of these marker organisms represent the cause or are they the effect? Like we hear of candida infection, we hear about blastocystis hominis infection. We know these are opportunistic organisms. Do they represent necessarily the cause of these problems or do they come associated with the problems of an imbalanced Th1, Th2 disturbed immune system?
Looking at the board in my office, which has a chicken and an egg on it, which is what that question reminds me of, it really comes down to changing the way we think about health and disease to one of homeostasis and balance, something you've been talking about for years. Because when we look at organisms, even something like blastocystis or candida, and we find that people normally have small amounts of candida in their gastrointestinal tract. It's not unusual at all. It's about being in right relationship and in balance with those things. It's when we become out of balance that we have problems. From a laboratory perspective, it's sometimes difficult because the people who authorize laboratories don't want to talk about something that's imbalanced. It's either a pathogen or it's not a pathogen. We find that high amounts of Klebsiella in people who have certain kinds of genetic predispositions and inflammatory processes with leaky gut where those antigens are being presented are going to have an increased risk of developing some autoimmune disease. That data has been around and published, you know, for the past 30 years. And yet it's not to say that if you have small amounts of Klebsiella in your gut that you have to use high-dose antibiotics in order to eradicate it. That's foolish. It's about how do we use our food and our nutrition to help bring us back into balance.
Well, that leads, Dr. Hanaway, to really the last question. I wish we could continue this on indefinitely. We've only touched the surface of all the research you represent. But let me, if I can, talk about these environmental modifiers of GI immune defense process or function. Clinically, we often hear not just about probiotics, but we also hear about prebiotics, the selective substrates from which then these commensal or symbiotic organisms can selectively grow. And you shared with me a very interesting article that opened up a whole new thought for me about the role that some of these prebiotics might play, and that has to do with the function of the GI immune tract and biofilms and how the biofilm environmental oligosaccharides might relate to an outcome in the phenotype of favorable immune balance. Could you tell us a little bit about that emerging concept of biofilms in the GI system?
Well, it's not only the gastrointestinal tract, one cell thick as big as a doubles tennis court, but that's actually covered by a film that includes the bacteria, but that the oligosaccharides are also present there, helping to create a further barrier function with what goes on in the normal gut. They're a part of the process of how we effectively relate and defend ourselves from our environment. So in the paper that you talked about from BMC Microbiology earlier this year, what they did is they looked at various strains of bacteria, and they found that the wild-type strain of people who had a good expression of biofilm that was associated with the colonization of normal good bacteria, normal good enterococci in the gut, and that the presence of those oligosaccharides in food, such as you talked about as prebiotics, can actually influence the formation of that biofilm. So it's not only feeding the bacteria, which is the way in which we've thought is the primary role of prebiotics, food sources, disaccharide food sources for bacteria, but also in the development of this layer that helps to coat the gastrointestinal tract and help it to be safe. So there's a whole series of things, and we're at the very beginning, nascent phases of learning the interaction between prebiotics and probiotics that I heard Mary Ellen Sanders talk about a year plus ago on this very show.
So really, when you get to introduce this concept, then it starts to connect with this whole mimicry issue of HLA-B27, possibly. And by forming the right biofilm, you may cover over certain receptors in such a way that you reduce the potential for mimicry. So it sounds like this whole communication process, again, with the gut as an antennae for the rest of the body's immune system, and how those antennae might be tuned in different ways depending upon the local environment.
Exactly.
Well, I can't thank you enough for sharing this time with us. This is obviously just the start of what needs to be an ongoing, continued evolution in this discussion, because as you point out in your review article, things like the hygiene hypothesis and how that interrelates with early stage atopic disorders in children, how that may relate to things like autistic spectrum disorders, and how that connects to the Andy Wakefield concepts of immune imbalances in this lymphoid nodular hyperplasia in children and autistic spectrum disorder, and how that then relates later to attention disorder, hyperactivity disorders in adults. There's a tremendous connection across many functional characteristics that knows no boundary in disciplines. This is not owned by gastroenterology, obviously.
No, it's not. And I want to actually give a plug to Joe Pizzarno and our naturopathic colleagues who have helped to champion these ideas and really bring them to the fore as well from a clinical perspective, because they work.
Dr. Hanoi, I want to thank you for helping us with this review paper that, again, appeared in the September-October issue of Alternative Therapies under the title Balance of Flora, Galt, and Mucosal Integrity. And I think if people read that article carefully and go back over it, they're going to have a whole level of education about this connection that can open up new important therapeutic doors with patients with complex chronic illness. So thanks for all of your contribution, and I hope through this discussion people will be more inclined now to maybe start down the path of functional gastroenterological testing and then using some of these tools to assist restoration of the immune defense.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for being there and helping to bring these ideas forward. Bye now.
In the range of clinically useful tools that we have discussed over the years in Functional Medicine Update, I can't help but feel that this discussion with Dr. Hanoi ranks right at the top, because it's so applicable to virtually every patient that comes in with complex chronic disease. The disorders that we have in the late 20th century, early 21st century in chronic disease are immunologically related, and certainly the gut plays such an important role in establishing immune defense function systemically as well as locally in the GI tract, that this whole model that Dr. Hanoi shared with us is critically important and translates directly into clinical practice. We know that you can actually evaluate gut microflora based upon people's diet, and you can see that the GI mucosal bacteria cluster around certain diets. And we know that the immune privilege of the gut is so tightly related to environmental factors of eating and stress and alcohol and chemical exposures and so forth. So I think this is one of those extraordinary opportunities to both listen and learn and then to do and start making a difference in your patients. So thank you again to Dr. Hanoi for his very, very lucid and insightful comments.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Blank. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.